Frank Salomé, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your work as a professor of Arabic language is very, very interesting. You've written a book most recently. You have several things coming out, but most recently one that was published, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East. And in this book, you talk about modern standard Arabic and how the teaching of modern standard Arabic is somehow intellectually stifling because it is not a living spoken language. Can you tell us what you mean by that being intellectually stifling?
When we say Arabic in the academy, when we teach Arabic, we say we teach Arabic. We're forming Arabists. We're forming people who speak Arabic. But in reality, it's people who use Arabic. We're usually talking about one kind of Arabic, and there are many kinds of Arabics. I argue that there are 36 different languages that are mutually unintelligible. Most of them are mutually unintelligible. That we refer to generically as Arabic. And there is a bona fide Arabic language. And Arabic is referred to as Fusha, which is in English modern standard Arabic. And that is the Arabic that we teach in the academy. So to give you an analogy that would be comprehensible to a Western audience, when I say I'm teaching you Arabic, and then I'm telling you, here, take 3 years of Arabic and then go to Egypt and speak to the Egyptians. In a Western context, this would be as if I were giving you 3 years of Latin and telling you to go to Naples or Milan and communicate with the peoples. So that's the Arabic that we teach. So it's a learned language. It's a ceremonial language. It's a language of literature. But it's nobody's natively spoken language. It's a language that is acquired through years and years of schooling. On the other hand, you have these 36 different varieties that are referred to as dialects. Some of them are mutually intelligible, others are not. And this would be comparable to, again, in a European context, to Italian, French, Portuguese, Romanian, and the relationships that these languages have among each other and with the mother language, Latin. Stifling, I'm not sure I used that term. Limiting, perhaps, that is because people don't use it natively, don't use it spontaneously. It is used in conversation among the educated, but it's almost always out of a prepared text. It is not a spontaneously spoken language.
So this, maybe the stifling or the limiting nature of it, as you suggest, then, is that it's misleading to think that there's any kind of modern standard Arabic that is inclusive of the entire Arab world, and that this somehow limits our understanding of this part of the world and leads to certain perceptions, some sort of monolithic whole, and isn't diverse and, you know, full of many different kinds of cultures and languages and ways of life.
That language that is common to all of the Arab-defined countries, that modern standard Arabic, is comprehensible to all of the users of this language as long as they've had formation in it. And that's why I stress the fact that it's not a natively used language. You have to go through schooling to. Linguists speak a lot in terms of diglossia, and that is, you know, having two language personalities, one for certain events, certain situations, and another for more sort of colloquial situations. But in the case of diglossia, both languages are learned at the same time. Both languages are acquired at the same time. That is not the case with Arabic. So Arabic is, in a sense, like Latin, that was used by bona fide Latins, Romans, as a native language, but was also used by barbarians and peoples who were conquered by the Latins, the Romans, who acquired that language eventually and distorted it over time and made out of it what we commonly refer to as French and Spanish and to a certain extent English.
I mean, but Frank, English, Arabic has a particular, it's loaded, it's very political in the sense that Islam connects to Arabic because Arabic, the Quran, is God sends down his message, the third package in this Abrahamic tradition, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and then the newest testament, the Quran, to the Arab people in the Arabic language.
Correct.
So it is God's language.
Correct.
And modern Arab nationalists said Arabic is the first language. I mean, they made this sort of romantic notion of Arabic being God's language, that Adam and Eve spoke Arabic. Zakiya Suzi, the Ba'ath Party founders and so forth, all say this, that Arabic is God's language and Semitic is the first language. But this is still at the heart of Arab nationalism. It's the heart of politics. I was just watching a video today of rebels going into Latakia area in northern Syria, pushing out government forces. And they are speaking this Fusha Arabic that you're talking about and saying that they are raising God's word to the top and that this is what they're doing. So this is a project. It's still ongoing in the Middle East. You're saying this is a false project?
I'm not saying it's a false project. I'm just saying that it's a daunting project. Arab nationalists have attempted it, started in the 1930s, 1940s. It still has not worked. I mean, when you have a situation where upwards of 50, 55% of the population is unable to function in that language, how can you enforce it? When you have to engage a literacy campaign before you engage a nationalist campaign, that's a daunting project. What you described about the holiness of the Arabic language being, you know, the language of Quran, etc., to a certain extent, that was the case of Latin as well. And that monopoly was broken because ultimately it's people who decide what they want to speak, what is, you know, their maternal, their mother language, they say in French, right. Langue maternelle, the mother language, the language that you learn from your mother. I don't see how this is going. It may succeed, but I don't see any signs that this is indeed going to succeed. There will be a great deal of opposition. This happened with Latin. Latin did not switch overnight to French and Italian and Spanish. The purists, the Latinists, the people who wanted to maintain the superiority of Latin fought it vehemently. I mean, you had groups in the 15th century France who refused to use Latin, who wanted to write exclusively in the vulgar language, in French.
It's also the case in Lebanon, isn't it? I mean, in not just in Lebanon, throughout the Middle East, you have churches, Christians in particular, whose liturgy is not in Arabic. There are some, like the Greek Orthodox, whose liturgy is in Arabic, but many others whose liturgy is not in Arabic, either in Aramaic or
right.
Where does this leave them? Is this Arabic language stifling for these minorities who hold up other languages?
Well, and just to get to that, add to that, Frank, I mean, the subtitle of your book is The Case for Lebanon. So you obviously take a particular focus on Lebanon, particularly for this reason that it doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the Middle East and that the language that we understand everyone to speak, it shapes and kind of misshapes our perceptions of that country and of that region.
Well, the case for Lebanon, the reason for the four in the subtitle is that my approach is that Lebanon could be looked at as perhaps a template, perhaps as an experiment where and it's always been a kind of a barometer where new ideas were tested and spread elsewhere. But to go back to your question, Josh, the churches that you mentioned, there has been a great deal of Arabization within churches whose liturgical languages had not been Arabic. The Maronite Church, for instance. I mean, the Maronites were the leaders in introducing Arabic into church rituals and prayers and so forth. But there is a movement now going back to either dialectalization or going back to Aramaic. So you'll see a return back to Syriac in the Maronite church, and others are following suit. But I want to go back to a point that I think is very, very important, because people, especially nationalists, are emotionally attached to their linguistic lodestar, the Arabic language for the Arab nationalists, the French for the French, etc. And we feel that language is this holy organism that we shouldn't tamper with, especially in the case of Arabic language, given its religious importance. In the 13th century, Dante published something you're probably familiar with, La Commedia, the comedy. That was the title of the book, the comedy. It wasn't divine yet. He was fought at the academy by his colleagues. who told him, how dare you write, because he wrote it in his vernacular. And I use Dante as an example because he is, in a way, the child of Virgil. He is the prince of Latin. I mean, nobody has beautified Latin as Dante has. And yet he writes in this vulgar language. But then everybody knows the book. Everybody understands the book. Even people who can't read, the book could be read to them and they could understand it. And over time, La Commedia became La Divina Commedia, the divine comedy, due to its subject matter, perhaps. But certainly, the divinity of it is attributable to the language, because it was a beautiful, vulgar language that he used. And when his colleagues at the Academy fought him, there's a parallel to this in the Middle East today among those literati who are writing, Egyptians who are writing in the Egyptian dialect, Lebanese who are writing in the Lebanese dialect, Syrians who are writing in the Syrian dialect, publishing. Dante was accused of using the language of the lower classes, the language of servants, not the language of academicians. And this was a verbal debate. And Dante's response was very similar to what goes on in the Arab world today, was that you are fighting my language choice in the language that I have chosen as a written language. They were not debating him in Latin. They were debating him in that lowly language. And that lowly language, he said, is your language, is my language, is the language of my mother, is the language of our prince. It's the language that we use on a daily basis. So that's a similar debate is ongoing today in the Middle East. Of course, you're going to have those who are emotively, religiously attached to the language who approach it from a different aspect, a different corner. But the debate is ongoing. And you have respectable literati who are attempting to normalize that tendency to write in the spoken language. And I mean, Najib Mahfouz, for instance, if you read his books in Arabic, he is also one of the princes of the Arabic language, a Nobel laureate. All of his internal dialogues in his novels are in spoken Egyptian. And that is because, like Dante, he feels that he could not express the innermost feelings of the masses, the subject of his book, unless he makes them speak in their spoken languages.
So just very quickly, tell us, should we not be teaching modern standard Arabic? Is that the ultimate argument here?
That is absolutely not my argument. My argument is that we should teach it. It has a function. It has a very important function. It is still the language of literature. I mean, you amputate people from their literature when you tell them don't use that language anymore. But what I suggest is that we learn it, we teach it the way we learned it in the Middle East. First, the mother language, and then the scholarly language.
Well, Frank Salomé, thank you so much for joining us today. You've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you for having me.